From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Nadia Raymond, sitting in for Maria Hinojosa. Latino music isn't always what people think it is.
So when people say, oh, punk is just this and just that, it's a white people thing. It's like, no, it's not. It's not.
Today, the story of Latino punk rock innovators and how covering a song can give it a new lease on life.
And right now it's about being cheated on. There were a lot of rum-fueled fights and even people getting shot over the song because people were insinuating that other people were being cheated on. It's kind of like if Baby Got Back got banned from the radio.
Plus, an interview with the Colombian-American singing sensation, Kali Uchis. Come hang with us as we bring you stories all about music that surprises by being a little bit offbeat. Stay with us. Thanks for listening to Latino USA. As summer winds down and you're scrolling through your smartphone looking for the next great thing, check out the TED Radio Hour. It's an amazing podcast that's like an idea incubator. It's a journey through fascinating ideas, fresh approaches to old problems, and new ways to just think and create. Find the TED Radio Hour podcast at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app. Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Nadia Raymond, and I'm the person that picks out music every week for our show. And today, I have the honor of sitting in for the fabulous Maria Hinojosa. Since I am the queen of music here at Latino USA, it is only fitting that the theme of today's show is music. But I need a Bonnie to my Clyde. And today, that Bonnie may sound a little familiar to you.
I just don't really understand why I have to be Bonnie and you get to be Clyde. Like, can it be the other way
Listen,
around?
Listen, I've just always sort of wanted to be Clyde. So I think you're just going to have to accept Bonnie for now.
Fine.
That's one of our amazing producers, Marlon Bishop.
Hey, guys.
Marlon is not really Latino, but he's been writing and making radio about Latin music for so many years that he's just the perfect co-host.
And I am super excited to be hosting the show with you today, Nadia.
I'm thrilled that you're here, too. Now, the theme of our show today isn't just music. We're bringing stories about Latino musicians who go off the beaten path or against the grain.
You know, musicians who challenge stereotypes about what quote-unquote Latin music even means.
Yeah. So that's why we're calling the show Offbeat. So, Marlon, as you know, I came up with an idea of how we're going to start the show today.
Yes, and I love this idea.
So, for our first segment, we're going to go deep, deep down into the wormhole of Latino cover songs.
Let's do this.
And we're going to kick things off with this little unknown tune. So unless you've just arrived on planet Earth, you've heard that song before. But, you know, just in case you haven't, it's La Bamba, probably the most famous Latino cover song of all time.
The great granddaddy of Latino cover songs.
The version of La Bamba that most people know is this one, the rock and roll version by Mexican-American teen heartthrob Richie Valens.
But the original version of La Bamba sounded more like this. So the version we're hearing right now is the Son Jarocho version. Richie Valens took a song that was really popular with his parents' generation in Mexico, and he flipped it. He put his Mexican culture in conversation with U.S. pop culture. Now, that might seem like kind of a simple act, covering this traditional Mexican song as a rock song, but there's actually a lot going on there.
Yeah, because often with Latino covers, it's not just a band redoing the same song that another band did. You're often changing styles, you're changing languages.
You're changing musical instruments.
You're changing the entire cultural context of the song, so there's a real transformation involved. So we thought we would play a few of our favorite contemporary Latino covers, you know, just to paint a picture of what we're talking about. Marlon, why don't you go first?
All right. I choose this song. Doesn't it just make you want to say huepa? This is, of course, a version of Jackson 5's I Want You Back by Tony Sukar and Tito Nieves, two salsa musicians. And I'll tell you why I love this cover. Little known fact, I have a confession here. I actually play in a wedding band on the weekends, and I Want You Back is the song that gets everybody on the dance floor. It is instant party.
I bet.
And salsa music is also instant party, so when you put them together, it is just like party explosion.
So next, I'm going to take it to a more low-key level. I'm going to play a song that was really popular back in 1999, and you may recognize it. That is Los Vikingos del Norte covering Red Hot Chili Peppers' Scar Tissue.
Off the album Californication.
You know, first of all, it's really clear that English is not the singer's first language, and I sort of find that really endearing. And I also really like it because it's norteño, and it's also a 90s hit, and I feel like it's something I can play for my stepdad, and he could totally relate. It was always sort of a disconnect between what I listened to and what my parents heard, and this just brings it all together. So what do you have for us next, Marlon?
I'm going to play Will You Love Me Tomorrow by Leslie Grace. Tonight you're mine completely. So it starts off, you think it's just kind of an original doo-wop version.
Yeah, and I'm like, I'm right in 1960 with you.
Okay, and wait for it. Kisses. Bachata.
Bachatazo.
This was actually a big radio hit a few years ago in New York City. And for some reason, bachata and doo-wop just kind of naturally go really well together. The chord progressions are similar, pretty much right the same tempo. And also the themes, you know? So you have these kind of really melodramatic love songs, you know, Will You Still Love Me Tomorrow? It's kind of the classic song of amargura, you know, like of loss and bitterness. And another thing I love about this song is, you know, it's covering this classic American sound, you know, like America at the drive-in. And to have a Dominican artist cover that, it's kind of like saying, we belong in that image too.
That's totally what I love about covers. They're really defiant. They're like the kid taking dad's car out for a joyride. It's kind of an act of rebellion. Okay, so stay with me for a second. In the world of rock music, nothing is more rebellious than metal, right?
Okay, not sure if I agree, but I'll go with it.
So take the world's most famous metal anthems. What's one of the most unmetal things you could do to its dark, dark soul? What if you made them sound like your grandma's mariachi music? The band Metalachi does just that. They do mariachi covers of metal, and they put on a show. I mean, there's costumes, there's banter with the audience, there's giant hats, leather pants, face paint, the whole nine yards. So you can imagine how pumped I was when I got to sit down with this guy.
Mi nombre es Vega de la Roca, and I am the singer of Metalachi.
All right, this guy sounds amazing.
I remember the first time we played Black Sabbath. It was epic. It was actually at a quinceañera.
What happened?
Well, this lady started to get all crazy. And we said, oh, my God, you know, if we're able to get the people rooting for us because of this type of music, then why not do it? Maybe other people will like it.
And people loved it. Their fans don't mess around when it comes to having fun.
When you come to a show, you have to come prepared to party. If you drink, I mean, the more you drink, the better we sound. We play like metal anthems, Crazy Train, Living on a Prayer. But my all-time favorite is Sweet Child of Mine.
Why do you like Sweet Child of Mine?
This is a song of love.
Because I used to have a girlfriend named Chayo, and so I say, Sweet Chayo of Mine.
I love you.
You know, all camp aside, the thing with Metalachi is that metalheads love Metalachi.
I think it's the passion that we put into the music. I mean, mariachi music itself, the instruments, it's so much passion in those instruments. I think that catches their attention, you know?
So just as a note, as a metal kid, and yes, I was and kind of still am one, metalheads feel a lot of feel, so this totally makes sense to me. Mariachi and metal, though, they have a lot in common. They both have big operatic voices, and both genres are music that working class folks listen to. Not to mention, metal is huge in Mexico.
Mariachi is a type of music that, being Mexican, it totally resonates. And metal, well, metal is awesome. If, for instance, you're Mexican, but you're a metalhead, and then you hear it as a mariachi cover, it does give you a feel of belonging.
So, yeah, it's like two parts of yourself coming together through these covers.
Totally.
Okay, so I have to say, despite not being a metal fan even in the slightest, I thoroughly enjoyed Metalachi, so thank you for bringing that to us.
Well, if I got you to like Metalachi, then my job here is basically done.
All right, so Metalachi's version of a cover is they're taking English language songs and kind of Mexifying them. I spoke with an artist who has a different approach. She took a classic Latin American song and put a contemporary new sound to it.
My name is Yarina de Marco.
Yarina is based in New York. Her parents are Brazilian and Dominican, and she grew up all over the world. And a lot of her music plays with this sense of biculturalness. Anyway, she made a cover of this song. If you don't know it, this is El Venao. It's a classic Dominican merengue from 1995.
This song was huge all over Latin America, and it was also kind of dirty.
And this is what Yarina's cover version sounds like.
Okay, so I should probably start by saying El Venao is about being cheated on. And when you get cheated on, you grow horns. This is like the way people talk about it.
That's so in Spanish, you mean?
In Spanish, yeah.
You say,
so if you're cornudo, if you have horns, that means somebody cheated on you. So people on the street would mess around with other people and put their fingers up next to their head and pretend like they had horns behind their backs. It was also the era of like the animal songs. So there was El Pollito. So there was a lot of like raunchy songs on the radio with animals. Yeah. And it was like Aesop's Fables of raunchiness in bachata and merengue.
And Yarina explained to me that this song, El Venao, actually caused a lot of problems.
There were a lot of rum-fueled fights and even people getting shot over the song because people were insinuating that other people were being cheated on. So it was banned for a while. It's kind of like if Baby Got Back got banned from the radio. It was like that myth of that song that was bad when I was a kid. And so that's kind of why I was interested in it. People from Costa Rica to DR to Brazil to anywhere know the song. I mean, it's part of our collective psyche. So I thought to put it in this modern music to this, you know, old song would be really interesting and funny. It's really, you know, it's not that serious. I thought it would be kind of like a wink-wink situation. It's like an homage to the kind of the kitsch of DR that I love.
I love that idea that a cover is kind of a wink to your audience. You know, those who get it, and those who don't get it, they don't get it. In any case, Yarina is totally on board with our idea that there is something rebellious about covering a song sometimes.
It's also like nostalgic and endearing, and it's just like the sense of smell. It floods you with a sense of familiarity and just time travel.
I love the way Yarina says that. It's so true. Covers definitely take you back, but at the same time, they help you see a song in a whole new way.
It's kind of like an Instagram filter in a way, you know? It's like you have a photo, but all of a sudden, there's kind of a different tint to it or different things are brought out.
Yeah, and the thing with Latino covers is there's this whole other element. I mean, if you feel like you belong somewhere, but you are often told that you don't, covering a song and putting a Latino spin on it is this really subversive thing. It says, see, I do belong here. Coming up on Latino USA.
I mean, my mom knows a hell of a lot more about punk than a lot of punks do. You know, and I'm not talking about naming off bands, but we're talking about the sort of essence and the energy and the reasons.
Punk rock moms and clubbing in the borderlands. Stay with us.
Thank you.
Hey, guys. Thanks for listening to Latino USA. So, if you like what you hear, we would really appreciate it if you would just do us a solid and write us a review on iTunes. Any length of review helps, really. Just let us know what you think. We always love to hear from you. And you may not know this, but we're a small independent nonprofit, so we really depend on listeners' support to help bring the stories that you like to hear on air. So if you are feeling generous and you would like to donate, you can go to latinousa.org and click on the donate button. And thank you so, so much. We really appreciate it.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Lumber Liquidators, a proud sponsor of NPR, offering more than 400 styles, including hardwood, bamboo, laminate, and vinyl, with flooring specialists in hundreds of stores nationwide. More at lumberliquidators.com or 1-800-HARDWOOD. And American Jewish World Service, working in developing countries to end poverty and advance human rights since 1985. More information is available at ajws.org.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Nadia Raymond, sitting in for Maria Hinojosa, here with my buddy, Marlon Bishop.
Hey, hey, hey.
So today, you may remember we're spending the whole hour talking about music, music that goes against the grain.
Or you could say music that blurs borders.
And speaking of borders, this next story takes place on the U.S.-Mexico border. And it comes from an idea you had, Marlon, when you were out reporting recently, right?
Yeah. So I was out reporting in Arizona for a different episode of Latino USA. And I was working with a photographer friend of mine named Alicia Fernandez. She's from Ciudad Juarez in Mexico, which is a city of about 1 million people right on the border with Texas. It's right across from El Paso. Anyway, we were talking about music one day, and she was telling me about this dance club in Juarez called Hard Pop. It's this place that's been mentioned in all kinds of DJ magazines as one of the best electronic music clubs in the world. Touring DJs will skip over much bigger cities in Mexico, like Mexico City, but they'll go to Juarez just to play at Hard Pop.
Whoa, that's crazy, because not only is Juarez kind of a provincial city in Mexico, it was also, like, considered the most dangerous city in the world for a long time.
Yeah, exactly. That's what was kind of fascinating to me about this as well. And so I called up my friend Max Pearl.
Hey, Marlon, how are you?
Max is a journalist who writes for Resident Advisor. It's a British dance music publication. And I asked him to help me understand how a world-class nightclub could crop up in a tough border town like Juarez.
So yeah, part of my day job is to go over all the listings for DJs who are touring internationally. And I keep coming across this club in Juarez called Hard Pop.
Hard Pop is definitely one of the main club institutions in North America, for sure.
So that's Brooklyn-based DJ and producer Francis Harris, one half of the duo Frank and Tony. He's a big-time DJ and tours all over the world. His first gig at Hard Pop was 7 years ago.
You know, it's in, like, this kind of normal strip mall, but on the outside of it has the big posters of who's playing there. It just seems sort of like this, like, little oasis in the middle of, like, a normal shopping center.
It's not a flashy place. They went for a dark, moody atmosphere, and most of the club is taken up by its dance floor.
The centerpiece is a high-end sound system designed by a team of engineers in the U.S., and the crowd is famously in touch with what's hot in electronic music right now.
The one thing I always remember about Hard Pop, they're always like, look, like they're really focusing on the music. You know, it's not like they're standing around like chit-chatting with each other.
People trade the producers like big, big rock stars.
That's Edgar Cobos, one of the guys behind Hard Pop. He runs PR and does artist relations, meaning it's his job to pick up international talent at the airport. He says DJs would get kind of freaked out by the huge military presence in the town.
They saw the checkpoints and they tell me, are you sure that tonight we're going to have a good party? And they were like a little nervous, but they went to make the gig and it was magic inside the club. The DJs and the producers felt that and they tell me, wow, amazing.
Cobos began promoting electronic music parties in Juarez in the early 2000s after having his mind blown by the rave scene right across the border in El Paso. He and the club's future owner, Ricardo Tejada, would cross the border on weekends to attend giant warehouse parties.
Together with Ricardo and a few other friends, they began bringing these big top 40 trance DJs to Juarez. Guys like Tiesto or Paul van Dyk, who sell out stadiums in Europe.
But then they grew up and got tired of the more commercial stuff and set out to build a scene around deeper house and techno music.
The idea was to bring a little bit of the Berlin techno underground to northern Mexico, and it worked. The little 500-capacity nightclub opened in 2006 in a shopping mall complex outside of downtown Juarez. And within 2 years, It was packed with kids from both sides of the border.
But it wasn't just hard pop that was booming. At that time, the whole city was swimming in cash.
You have like a boom from a lot of new business, a lot of new cars, a lot of new rich guys on the city.
And the cause of that boom?
It was the wash of the money from the narcs and the mafias.
When he says wash of the money, he means money laundering. Loose drug money was flying all over the city, and some of it landed at hard pop.
Unfortunately, that's also when the city began to feel the first tremors of a savage turf war between rival drug cartels, vying for key routes across the U.S. border.
And in that moment, the whole society noticed that there were, like, new people in town.
That's Alicia, the photojournalist from Juarez who tipped Marlon off to hard pop in the first place.
The whole society were feeling afraid. They were shooting in the restaurants, in the bars, in the streets.
Like all the after parties, we were talking, do you know what is happening right now? Do you know that the mafia is getting more control of the streets? Yes.
Violence had long since become a factor of life for working class people in Juarez. But now it was starting to spill over and affect the more sheltered middle class.
By 2010, the conflict was at its height, with an average of nearly 300 murders per month. For a little bit of context, that's about the number of murders every year in New York City these days. Alicia was working for a local newspaper at the time, photographing dead bodies by day. But at night, she'd go to hard pop and try to be a normal 20-something on the dance floor.
There were these places that you can go and have fun and see your friends and think for a little bit of time that not all the things were lost.
For the hard pop crew, the violence hit closest to home in that August, on a night when Alicia was scheduled to meet her friend Tamara Deborah, known to her friends as Hazel.
Hazel was a very nice girl. She was, like, very funny. She was always smiley.
They were supposed to meet at hard pop, but Hazel never made it to the club that night. She was having drinks at a different bar beforehand when cartel members showed up.
They arrived, this group of kidnappers, and they shoot six people, and they kill her.
Hazel was simply in the wrong place at the wrong time. And she wasn't the only member of the scene that disappeared.
I used to call it, like, holes, because they used to always take in that space to dance, and after they were killed, there was this hole. All the city is full of holes.
Finally, in 2010, they decided to close their doors. They didn't want anyone to end up hurt at their club. But the local club kids weren't exactly going to let them off the hook.
They telling us on their social medias, don't close the club. It's the only thing that we have. We don't have places to dance. We don't have places to hear music. Don't leave the city. Don't leave us.
As 2011 rolled along, the gang violence began to ease up. Few people agree on exactly why and how, but it was likely a number of factors. The arrest of key cartel leaders and a major victory over one cartel by another. Hard pop cautiously opened back up in 2012.
It is really coming back to life. There's a lot of new restaurants, a lot of new bars. You can see people outside in parks. I mean, there's just life again.
That's David Teruel. He's been the club's resident DJ for 8 years now, and he's seen it through good times and bad.
The one place that has kept offering parties for us to try to escape this reality that we have in the city.
While I was doing interviews with people at hard pop, I kept hearing this refrain about what makes hard pop special.
And, like, the most common comment about it is the people. The people are very into the music. They really give into the DJ that's coming to play, and it really creates a great energy. That's the main thing, the main comment we get from DJs. Like, wow, the people.
I mean, hard pop may look great from a distance because of its lineups and sound system and everything, but when you get up really close, the thing that makes it really special, really different from other clubs, is the community that's built up around it.
I mean, imagine you're in this situation where it feels like the world is just falling apart around you every day. Wouldn't you also dance like it was your last night on Earth? Because
Actually, it kind of could be. Thanks, Max, so much for helping us tell this story.
It was a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
By the way, we have some great photos from Hard Pop from over the years, courtesy of photographer Alicia Fernandez, who you heard in that story. They're up on the website. Go and check them out at latinousa.org.
So let's go now from hard pop to hardcore. So as a rock and roll kid, hearing about young people in Juarez who created this vibrant electronic music scene out of nothing, it automatically made me think about punk music.
Totally, I can see that.
And it just so happens that our next story is about a hardcore punk band. So a little background first. Punk rock was developed in the 70s when bands like the Ramones stripped rock and roll down to something that was really bare and raw.
But then in the early 80s, a new genre of punk started to brew. Bands like Bad Brains took that rawness to another level. The sound was called hardcore.
It was faster, tougher, looser. In the 90s, enter Los Crudos.
The first time I listened to Crudos.
The first time I heard Los Crudos.
Was at a buddy's house.
I remember my friends being stoked on them.
And at the drop of the needle.
Automatically, you know, hearing Asesinos.
Asesino.
Asesino!
And I was just like, whoa, this is like the rawest that I've ever heard.
Just play rock and roll and be brown and happy about it.
Though Latinos had been in the punk scene since the beginning, shout out to Descadena from Black Flag, Los Crudos was one of the first punk bands to be unapologetically Latino. Julia Alsop tells us the story behind the band.
People kind of really disregard punk, and I try to explain to people that in communities like the ones that I grew up in, punk has saved kids' lives. My name is Martin Sorondegui. I'm the vocalist of multiple punk bands, Los Crudos, Limbrus, Needles.
Though ferocious on stage, Martin is sweet and laid back in person. Martin and his family landed in the Pilsen neighborhood of Chicago in 1968 from Uruguay. There was tension on the streets.
There was a sort of imaginary border between what was the Italian neighborhood and a Mexican neighborhood.
Kids gathered every day with bats and bottles.
There was this kind of race war that happened.
While other kids he knew were getting into gangs, Martin was getting into punk.
There was this aesthetic thing that, you know, was calling me. I just thought it looked really cool. It looked tough. It looked just wild.
But the punk scene in Chicago was mostly in the north, the more white side of town, not in Pilsen.
And then we started, you know, jumping on the trains to go to shows way up north, and people would kind of freak out and look at us and be like, where the hell do these kids come from? I got arrested one night when I was a closet punk.
Martin got picked up for breaking curfew and having a fake ID. He was 16.
My dad walked into the police station at 2 in the morning and freaked out. And they're like, is that your son? He's like, yeah, that's my son. And like, cat's out of the bag. Like, I look punk. I'm into punk.
But rebellion was actually something Martin learned at home.
I mean, my mom knows a hell of a lot more about punk than a lot of punks do. You know, and I'm not talking about naming off bands, but we're talking about the sort of essence and the energy and the reasons and the why. I mean, my mom was the woman who challenged me on punk. The reality is my mother was the person who politicized us.
Back in Uruguay, Martin's mom was a socialist. In the house, she played the protest music she'd grown up with.
These were famous folk singers who had lyrics that were so potent, they all had to flee the country.
Qué pena si este camino fuera de muchísimas leguas.
And this was my mom planting seeds.
Y siempre se repitiera.
But in high school, Martin was still trying to find himself.
I had lost a lot of my Spanish. I was really conflicted with that. And I was conflicted with the sort of process of assimilation and how that happened.
And music was his way to reconnect. Martin started a band with three other Latino kids from the neighborhood. They would sing about things like immigration, war, and colonialism. And he'd relearn Spanish while he was at it. In this clip we're about to hear, Martin uses a word that some people might find offensive.
A friend of mine told me, oh, yeah, that dude was talking to me. He's like, oh, Martin from that Spick band? When it came back to me, I was like, really? That dude said that? It kind of bugged me, but I was like, you know what? I'm going to write a song called. Like, there's no shame in this. And I do want non-Spanish speakers to know what it's about.
At first, Crudos thought they would just be some neighborhood band, playing basements in Pilsen, and maybe, if they were lucky, around Chicago. But when their first demo got written up in Maximum Rock and Roll, the longest-running punk magazine, letters from fans and invites to play shows started pouring in from all over the world.
When we played Mexico City the first time, there were like 1,000 people at our show, which was shocking. I mean, we were playing small shows in the States, and it was just like, what just happened?
Los Crudos was a beacon for Latino punks.
That's rock critic and punk musician Mariam Bastani.
So you're trying to be a punk kid, but you keep hearing about this unrest and death in your homeland. It's going to weigh heavily on you. Who do you talk to about it?
We were finding wherever we were going, even if it was in Europe, there were people showing up who were like, hey, you know, my family exiled from Argentina and I grew up here, and, you know, they were just identifying with it.
The song's called Sin Caras, means without faces. It's the people who sometimes become invisible. It's talk about the immigrants living in New York, New Jersey, the East Coast. So the song's going to all of them. A toda la gente inmigrante en este cuarto, en esta ciudad. No, Sin Caras, la última.
Los Crudos is always revered in the context of a hardcore band, right? Don't think that's not doing it justice. Los Crudos is part of a lineage of revolution that is a strain within Latino culture.
So when people say, oh, punk is just this and just that, it's a white people thing, it's like, no, it's not. It's not.
My name is Juan Carlos Silva.
My name is Matthew David Trejo.
I'm Anthony Gaviria.
I play in a few punk bands. It's Freak Vibe.
I sing in Condition.
Everybody in our band is Latino.
Los Crudos are probably the new jacks out there. Trampas, whatever. Check it out.
For Latino USA, this is Julia Alsop.
Reed Dunley contributed reporting to that piece.
And seriously, I had no idea about the history behind that band. It's really cool.
I know, they're really rad. I feel really energized now. Coming up on Latino USA.
My name is Andy Sanchez, and I'm 8 years old. When I'm all by myself, I feel like I'm not doing really good. And when I'm with all the cello people and the violinists, I feel happy because we're all playing and we all do no songs together.
This adorable child is learning to play classical music through a new system developed in Venezuela. We're going to find out all about it. Stay with us. Thanks for listening to Latino USA. As summer winds down and you're scrolling through your smartphone looking for the next great thing, check out the TED Radio Hour. It's an amazing podcast that's like an idea incubator. It's a journey through fascinating ideas, fresh approaches to old problems, and new ways to just think and create. Find the TED Radio Hour podcast at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.
Gente, esse samba quente que é muito legal. É super pra frente, é bem genial. Embalo como este, só quem vai curtir. Quem não se machucar quando deixa cair. Por isso vem, vem, quem parou na nossa. Este balanço tira qualquer um da fossa. Ele é um barato e é da pesada. Este é o famoso 16 toneladas. E bolei o ano inteiro este samba pra frente. É gostoso o parque, é um samba decente. Segura esta conversa, segura a jogada. Quem não gostar de samba, não gosta de nada. E a curtição, o samba empolgado. É um flamengão no estádio lotado. Turma da pesada que segura a parada. Isso é o famoso 16 toneladas.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Emily and Antoine Van Ochtmail, supporting New Futures, which works to help low-income D.C. area youth graduate from community college or certificate programs and become financially self-sufficient. Information is available at newfuturesdc.org. And Carnegie Corporation of New York, supporting innovations in education, democratic engagement, and the advancement of international peace and security. More information is available online at carnegie.org.
You're listening to Latino USA. I'm Nadia Raymond, sitting in for Maria Hinojosa, and hanging with my co-conspirator Marlon Bishop as we bring you stories about music that is offbeat.
Music that messes with people's expectations.
Now I'm going to get a little giddy because we're going to briefly mention one of my favorite bands ever.
Could it be Los Ketchup?
Could you be more wrong? I'm so offended. It's Calle 13. When Calle 13 played at the Latin Grammys in 2011, they had backup from an unusual band, the Simón Bolívar Symphony Orchestra, but it's no stuffy classical music ensemble. Its style is electric and really showy.
It's one of the top orchestras in Venezuela, and its director is actually somebody you might have heard of, Gustavo Dudamel. He's the hotshot young Venezuelan conductor that the classical music world has been totally freaking out about recently.
The program behind the orchestra is called El Sistema. Its mission is to create social change through music.
And apparently, it's blowing up in the U.S.
Jonathan Wolf has the story.
Everything. Everything I am is because of El Sistema.
That's Jorge Soto, a Venezuelan musician and conductor based in Boston.
I come from a very, very humble family.
He began in El Sistema when he was 8 years old.
And the only reason I started in music is because my parents thought that they couldn't afford a babysitter. And because it's totally free, completely free, it's probably the only free thing you can do in Venezuela, you know.
El Sistema is a national classical music program run by Venezuelan conductor José Antonio Abreu. It offers kids free classical music lessons. Abreu started in the 70s out of a garage, with just 11 students. In the 80s, Abreu became Venezuela's Minister of Culture, and as the program grew, it took on the mission of teaching poor kids, like Jorge Soto. The late President Hugo Chavez became its biggest funder and promoter. Here's Abreu speaking in 2009.
The huge spiritual world that music itself produces overcomes material poverty.
Termina por vencer la pobreza material.
Abreu has promoted the idea of democratizing classical music. He feels it shouldn't be the realm of the elite, but a discipline to create better citizens.
Y claro está.
Clearly, music is the number one prevention against prostitution, violence, bad habits, anything that can degrade the life of a child.
Contra todo lo que involuciona o degrada la vida de los niños.
Abreu won a TED Prize, which he used to set up a fellowship program at the New England Conservatory of Music in Boston. It allowed 50 fellows to travel to Venezuela, learn about El Sistema, and then start their own programs back home. One of those fellows is Julie Davis.
Sorry, I lost my train of thought.
Sitting in a Boston cafe, she says El Sistema is a huge part of Venezuela's everyday culture.
But Venezuela just makes it happen. You know, if they don't have instruments, they have a choir. You know, if they don't have rehearsal space, a grandmother will donate her house.
After her visit, Davis started her own El Sistema program at Bridge Boston Charter School. U.S. programs like Davis's aren't official branches of the Venezuelan system, but are rather modeled after it. Davis's program is rigorous, with practice every day, but...
El Sistema is not a pedagogy. It's not a way of teaching music. It's an inspiration point.
So what began as free and demanding classical music lessons in Venezuela became much more loose in other countries, and today reflects the needs and goals of individual communities.
Melkis, is that you? Open D. Can you do it anyway? D, yellow.
My name is Andy Sanchez, and I'm 8 years old. When I'm all by myself, I feel like I'm not doing really good. And when I'm all with all the cello people and the violinists, I feel happy because we're all playing and we all do new songs together.
My name is Gabriel Goji. I play the violin. I helped a student when he needed help with his bow hold on the violin.
El Sistema follows kids from the elementary level to the professional level. Julia Bonfin, who's from Brazil, is an El Sistema teacher.
So beginners get to play with intermediate players and also with like professional musicians. So that's a very good experience for them.
El Sistema has expanded to more than 100 programs in the U.S. The Los Angeles Philharmonic is even creating a national youth orchestra modeled on El Sistema. But the program has its critics.
Actually, many of El Sistema's core ideas make little sense if you stop and think about them.
Jeffrey Baker is a music professor at the University of London. He's the author of El Sistema, Orchestrating Venezuela's Youth.
Like the idea that the symphony orchestra is a model for an ideal society, or that playing in a symphony orchestra turns you into a model citizen. I mean, think, have you ever talked to an orchestral musician? You know, what's the reality of life in a symphony orchestra? It's actually quite different.
Baker also says there's a lack of innovation and creativity in the El Sistema orchestra model, and that its founder, Abreu, exercises too much control.
It should be run much more democratically, much more transparently, ideally with children and young people involved in running the organization as well as just providing musical labor.
For his part, Jorge Soto acknowledges Abreu's strong influence. But, he says...
Music system, political system, no system is perfect.
These days, Soto is a conductor at Boston's prestigious Longy School of Music. He's come a long way from his humble start with El Sistema in Venezuela.
Listen, it helped me. I'm helping kids here. El Sistema has done results. You can see results. Play, not only play, but at the highest possible level.
Someday, that's what these second graders at Bridge Boston Charter School may do. They haven't noticed the controversy.
And do you know anything about El Sistema?
No.
But that doesn't seem to matter.
I like playing violin and I think it's fun. And you can learn more about instruments.
So, while the adults debate, the kids play on. For Latino USA, I'm Jonathan Wolf.
Those kids sound so, so cute.
Yeah, something about a already tiny, cute child with a tiny violin just makes it more adorable.
Yeah, it's the proportions. Next up, a new artist who draws inspiration in part from old music.
Not old as in 18th century classical old. Think 1950s. Jazz, soul, doo-wop.
We're hearing the song Lottery by Kali Uchis. She's a 22-year-old Colombian-American artist who grew up between Colombia and Northern Virginia, and she totally rocks.
If I told you I was yours, you'd probably label me a bug. Maybe I'm just trying way too hard to keep you. You're an angel.
Her music has this nostalgic retro vibe, almost like this suspended in time feeling.
But her music and style are inflected by hip-hop and Latin pop as well. And something about the way she pulls it all together, it's really struck a nerve. In a flash, she went from recording songs in her bedroom in high school to becoming one of the buzziest new acts around, with cosigns ranging from Snoop Dogg to Tyler, the Creator.
And lucky for us, we convinced her to take a break from being the next big thing to come up to our studios in New York City and join us for an interview. Welcome to Latino USA, Kali.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So I was just looking through your Twitter today before the interview, and I saw the tweet where you said, missing Selena, Amy, and Aaliyah. Amy, I'm guessing, Amy Winehouse. And I thought it was so interesting that you picked those three artists. Why those three?
All of them had so much like power and so much confidence and independence in themselves. Just seeing them and just hearing them like be who they were was inspiring.
I also love just kind of as far as your musical identity, it kind of, you have someone who's a Latina icon, someone who was like a soul and jazz icon, and someone who's very hip-hop. And those are all things that you embody in a way.
I mean, those were definitely like some of my main, like I looked up to them, and Gwen Stefani and No Doubt.
So one thing that we've noticed as a theme in your music has been just that there's a lot of strong women. There's strong women in your lyrics. You're a strong woman. And the way you present yourself also in your videos is very much like you're in charge of every situation. Let's hear a little bit from Know What I Want, which is one of your most popular songs. So were you purposely putting women in the forefront as a theme when you were making videos like this and songs like these?
That's how my aunt raised me. A lot of girls don't have people in their lives that are women in their lives that are telling them how important it is to really be strong and really know your own worth. And so I feel like it is really important for girls to understand how powerful they actually are.
In your music, there's a really clear jazz influence.
Right.
And I was listening to the Electronic Beats mixtape that you did, and the second song on it, I believe, was a Billie Holiday song.
I love Billie Holiday.
Tell me a little bit about how jazz has impacted your life.
Well, I used to be in jazz band when I was younger. I picked up the saxophone, and I used to play keys. Once I started listening to Billie Holiday, it was like, I just felt really connected to like everything she would always talk about. Everything that she did was kind of just like a reflection of like, I feel like growing up, how you kind of feel.
It's interesting how something kind of so old can be so contemporary also.
So one of the songs that I think sort of reminds me of that feeling that you're talking about is Loner.
I don't want to be a cigarette. I don't want to be an ashtray. I don't want to be your doormat.
So what sort of inspired that song?
That one in particular was inspired by a relationship, but it kind of just applies to everything. You don't need anybody to make you feel secure within yourself or to give anything substantial to your life. No one can give you anything that you can't give yourself or that you can't do for yourself.
So how did you make the jump? You were playing jazz saxophone basically in high school, and how did you make the jump to your music career and the music that you make now?
It just happened so naturally, where like I was forever writing songs. And then when I got my first computer is when I finally actually started like recording stuff.
So you were kind of just opening up GarageBand and singing into it, or?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was looping songs that I liked, and I was just singing over samples.
The most popular song on your album by Listens is Rush. Let's take a listen to that for a second.
Stay afloat when it feels like it's all going.
I noticed that so much of your kind of social media, you're always really repping Colombia a lot. You're not shy about proclaiming your Latin Americanness.
I really dislike when people try to say that I'm from places that I'm not. There's so many rumors about like I'm from California and stuff, and like I'm not even in America, I'm not from California, I'm from Virginia.
And what was it like to come to Virginia for the first time?
It was fun, cuz like when we first got to Virginia, it was like we didn't really have anywhere to go. So we lived in a camper for a while, and then we just kind of like lived with different people. It's definitely never boring.
So is it just you and your family, or do you have siblings?
I have like three brothers and one sister, but we kind of grew. My sister went into foster care when she was a teenager, so she left home before we really got to like have like a sister relationship.
So describe a little bit sort of what influences you, and how do you see yourself?
I'm from different places, so it's like, because I consider myself both from Virginia and from Colombia, so it's like, and that's okay. It's okay to claim different places. Like, I don't know why everyone acts like I can only claim one place.
Yeah, I was going to say, I feel like it's people reacting to the way that you look more than to anything that you're saying or anything that you're making.
They're like, oh, this girl does her makeup like a chola. She's got like lowrider songs, whatever. And I'm just like, nah, I just want people to get it right. That's it. I just want the truth to be out there. Because even if you go to Colombia, like, this is how someone would do her makeup. And I just want people to know that I'm not from California, I'm not Mexican, and I don't claim either.
You know, we've heard from a few artists over the years say that they've been kind of encouraged to play their Latino-ness down because they're afraid that, like, that could hurt their career.
Yeah, it's true. It's like there's a role and a place and a time to be Latino. It's just such a fine line between, like, what's cool and what's not, and they just like want to pick and choose like what parts of our culture are like acceptable, and I'm just tired of that.
What do you hope people get out of your music? Like, when you're putting a song out there or you're putting a new mixtape or a record, who do you hope it speaks to, and what do you hope it's saying to people?
The same way I feel when music makes me happy. Like, I want it to feel like you're able to escape. After listening to it, you feel a little bit better about your situation and you feel a little bit more confident in yourself and take the necessary actions that you need in your life to do better and be better and progress for yourself.
Thank you so much for joining us on Latino USA.
Thank you for having me.
You are my place of worship. I heard you the block and I'll be the circuit. When I got caught, I hope that you're
so sadly, all good things must come to an end, and we now have to say goodbye. But before we do, as you know, we're going to end with something we call sabiduría. It's a little nugget of wisdom. Since the theme of today's show is music that follows its own rules, I thought I'd tell a story that I've actually never told before.
Ooh, I am excited for this one.
So when I was a goth kid in suburban Ohio, I felt like the only all-black wearing, Smashing Pumpkins jamming, awkward Latino kid with weird political parents. And then my first serious crush did something that changed everything. He gave me Rage Against the Machine's Evil Empire. You remember that record? It was the first time I heard someone that spoke Spanglish, rocked out hard, and also referenced the books I was into at that time on a stage. It sounds silly, but seeing Zach de la Rocha doing his thing made me feel less alone. So I wrote fan mail.
No, you didn't.
I did. At the end, I went off on an angsty paragraph that just thanked them over and over and over again for, quote, saving my life. You know, although that's a super 15-year-old thing to say, the truth is it felt so real at that time. And loving outsidery music passionately still feels kind of defiant. It's believing that we're all connected through something greater, something we really can't see, but we know very much that it's there.
You know, Nadia, the 15-year-old goth inside of you is such a cheeseball, but I love her anyway.
You should have read my diaries. That's it for this week. Latino USA is produced by my partner in crime, the irreplaceable Marlon Bishop, Daisy Rosario, Lita Hartman, Michael Simon Johnson, Antonia Cerejido, Julia Alsop, and Sarah Barrett. Our engineer master of disaster is Cornelius McMoyler. Nancy Trujillo is the cream in our coffee, and she makes it all happen. A very, very special thanks to the entire team for making this music geek feel right at home. Our show was founded at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm your guest host and Latino USA music consultant, Nadia Raymond, thrilled, delighted, and so honored to be sitting in for host and executive producer, the rad, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week, and in the meantime, you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, and Instagram.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and the Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide.
It was faster, tougher, looser.
You did it again.
No?
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Jane and Michael Horvitz, supporting NPR and 90.3 WCPN IdeaStream in Cleveland, dedicated to building a more informed community together by producing in-depth journalism that informs, engages, and inspires. And the Kresge Foundation, expanding opportunities in America's cities through grant-making and social investing. More at kresge.org. This is NPR.